Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh, copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh, and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. Today we're beginning episode 16 on page 220 of this 247-page book. In the previous episode, Father McGettigan continued to minister to the bereaved families of Marystown. As winter approached, several made hard decisions to place children with nearby families who had a bit of extra food, or even in the orphanages in St. John's. Some villagers still felt the presence of ghosts among them. In 2003, the daughters of Ambrose's second marriage, Donnie and Kathy, have decided to fly from California to New Hampshire to meet at last the two sons of Ambrose's first family. Now, Episode 16. As I drive south from Maine to my New Hampshire childhood home, I imagine my dad and his half-sisters together getting to know each other after decades of separation. I consider my Nana, how she would have told my father, "It's the right thing to do. Invite them to your home. You're the oldest. It's your responsibility." For most of my Nana's life, she bridged her two families, the first six siblings born to her mother, and the other seven children born to her stepmother. My grandmother quelled the feuds, mended the hard feelings, and was forever trying to link her brothers and sisters together, and now my father tries to do the same. "I don't hold anything against them," he says of Kathy and Donnie. "Why would I?" Though my father has no qualms about meeting Ambrose's daughters, my mother, five sisters, and I still find this get-together surreal and strange. For most of their marriage, my mother had never asked about Ambrose. She knew my father did not want to talk about him, to resurrect the painful memories of his past. Protective of my father, my sisters and I are unsure of how we will feel in Kathy and Donnie's presence. They represent the family Ambrose chose over our dad. They symbolize the grandfather several of my sisters still resent. Still, we are curious. Will they look like us? Act like us? Will we like them? Hours after Kathy and Donnie arrive, I pull into my parents' driveway. Overhead, storm clouds loom, growing larger, closer. They are black and thick and will soon thunder and spark lightning that will crackle in the afternoon air. I muse about Patty and Ambrose, their spirits conspiring to create an August storm as a backdrop to this unexpected family gathering. Donnie and Kathy's visit comes so soon, 6 weeks after our trip to Marystown, and I wonder if their stay, their memories, will flesh out the grandfather I am beginning to know. What stories will they tell? What details will they choose to share about their lives and Ambrose? My parents' house is quiet, the kitchen, sun porch, and pool area empty. An uneasy feeling lurches in my stomach. Where are they? The living room is vacant, too. I head down the hall and open the den door. The air conditioner whirs on high, and my parents, Kathy and Donnie, are laughing at the black-and-white images that flicker on the television. They are watching videos of my sisters and me as young children. Our chubby legs pump backyard swings and attempt to climb a metal slide. My older sister, Diane, swings vigorously upside down on the monkey bar. Kathy and Donnie laugh as if they have seen this video before, as if they are part of our family. I am struck by how comfortable they are, how at ease my parents are in their company. I hug each of them, taking in their auburn hair, the color of their eyes. Kathy's are soft, hazel, and a bit guarded, watchful like my own. Donnie's brown eyes sparkle with light, reminding me of my sister Laura's luminescent gaze. Not long after I arrive, my Uncle Bill and his wife Pam pull up to my parents' home. Despite having moved to Michigan in 1970, my uncle has often driven to New Hampshire for his six nieces' weddings, for momentous birthday and anniversary celebrations, and he was not going to miss this gathering, the chance to meet his half-sisters. As with my father, Donnie and Kathy tear up when they see my uncle. Later they will tell each other, "He's got the same facial features and build as our brothers Michael and Jim." Kathy also appreciates my uncle's soft-spoken nature. She watches him listen intently to conversations. "He's like me," she thinks, "a listener, a bit shy." That evening, after the dinner dishes have been cleared, Ambrose's children sit at the kitchen table sharing stories, piecing together the secrets of their father's life. My dad always told me that I was 6 weeks old when he bundled me in his coat and drove me and my mother from Brooklyn to Florida, Kathy explains. A few months later, my mother and I took a bus across the country to San Francisco. Ambrose, Kathy explains, arrived before them on a yacht he was paid to sail to the fog-shrouded city. My father is stunned. He had not realized Kathy is the baby who suddenly appeared in their Mill Valley home. My mother took care of you, he tells her. For a few months you lived with us. Kathy cannot understand or fathom why my Nana would care for her, knowing that she was the child of Ambrose's mistress. Though her mother, Arlene, will later refuse to talk about why my Nana temporarily cared for Kathy, she does tell her daughter, "She was good to you. I walked up to see you every day and had tea with her. She was really nice to me." Kathy and Donnie wince as my father continues the story, explaining how Ambrose gambled away most of their money and eventually deserted them again. "It was tough, really tough on my mother," he says. "She had a nervous breakdown." Shaking their heads, Donnie and Kathy offer their apologies. They loved their father and never worried that he would leave them, but they understood how their dad's bad choices could cause chaos and pain. While raising his 6 children in California, Ambrose worked a variety of jobs, selling cars, painting commercial buildings, driving buses, but he often gambled away his paycheck, and sometimes he got fired for taking too much time off to bet on the horses. "You probably were better off without him," Donnie says, sharing a sentiment that her 4 other brothers have voiced about Ambrose's first 2 sons. My uncle and father fall silent. Eager to console, Kathy offers some of the good memories, stories of the years before Ambrose left his sons. "Before he died, my father opened up more about you," she tells my dad. "He talked about how close he was to you, how he bought you your first bike and taught you how to ride. He said the 2 of you used to go everywhere together. You used to stand on the car seat next to him as he drove, with your hand around his shoulders." My uncle listens quietly to these stories. It is painful to realize there are few memories for him. Still, he knows Ambrose saved his life. My uncle was only a few days old when he came home from the hospital and caught the whooping cough. Ambrose and his wife Patricia feared their second-born son would die. They watched as the infant closed his fists and flailed his arms, coughing and struggling to breathe. Determined not to lose another infant like their daughter, who was stillborn, Ambrose swaddled his brother Paddy's namesake and took William Patrick to 5 doctors. "There's nothing we can do," they told him. Ambrose refused to take their word. He sought out a chiropractor, who massaged the phlegm from his baby's lungs and told him to take the infant to the sea to breathe the cold, salty air. With several treatments, Ambrose's son overcame the cough and survived. Still, for much of his life, my uncle lived with a void, an emptiness, no recollection of his father. Though the stories Kathy and Donnie tell are difficult to hear, my uncle understands that his half-sisters are doing what they can to absolve Ambrose's wrongs. They want to know that we're happy, that we're okay. And even though Ambrose left us, he still thought about and loved his first 2 sons. Before they leave to return home to California, Kathy and Donnie witness a raucous birthday celebration in which all of our family—my parents, 5 sisters and me, my uncle, his wife, 8 grandchildren, 4 brothers-in-law, and even my Aunt Eleanor—all gather poolside for a barbecue. It is my father's 68th birthday that day, August 12th. The following day is my 45th birthday. Kathy and Donnie laugh at the insanity that unfolds around them. Kids jumping in and out of the pool, sisters brewing batches of margaritas, a wiffle ball game in the backyard. Growing up, they did not have these types of celebrations, and they are happy to take part, to be welcomed, to be considered family. Before the birthday candles are lit, my uncle has a surprise gift for Kathy, Donnie, and my father. Navy t-shirts with white bold block letters that read Walsh. Pulling the shirts over their heads, they pose for pictures. They line up, Kathy and Donnie on either side of my uncle and father. They smile and instinctively place their arms around one another. As I focus my camera on them, tears well up in my eyes. Never did I think the August gale, The desire to tell the story of my seafaring ancestors would lead to this, to Ambrose's children hugging, sharing the apologies their father could not voice. During the last few days of their stay, Donnie, the more loquacious of the two sisters, shares a wish with me. "I've always felt sad about your father," she says. "Out of all the brothers, he was the closest to my dad, and then his father leaves. You never get over it. That wound stays with you all your life. I thought maybe by visiting him we could resolve some of his heartache. I know he cannot quite forgive, but to let go of that anger would be the best thing." I nod, knowing my father has unburdened some of his bitterness, some of the anger. He has talked about Ambrose more in the last few months than he has over the past 5 decades. I think about the conversation my dad shared with me on a winter's night about the August gale, how a storm that wrought so much grief and loss could result in calming another tempest, the squalls and sorrow my grandfather stirred. Chapter 31. Left in a Dreamland, Newfoundland, 1935 to 2005. Bride Hanrahan still dreams about her father grasping for her as he thrashes in the roiling sea. Her hair is white, her eyes failing with age, but the vision she had as a young girl remains vivid, the flash of yellow oilskins, her father's face disappearing in the ragged waves. "It's the same dream I had the night my father drowned," Bride says. "I always see his hand reaching for me as he cries for help." 70 years have passed since the 1935 August gale, but the thought of her dad alone, sobbing in the sea during his final moments, still torments Bride. She cannot bear to look at her father's picture. The portrait makes her too lonesome for his company. She cannot smell or view the sea without shivering, and she cannot erase the memories of the gale or the days following the storm. "I still see Father McGettigan coming to our door," she says. "My mother knew. Get the candles," she told me, "so we can pray that your poor father is in heaven. You'll never see your dad no more." "Of course we will, Mom," the young bride argued. "Dad is going to come home." A month later, her family received another unexpected visit from Father McGettigan. The priest handed Bride's mother a letter from the constable in Harbor Buffett, a village in Placentia Bay. The note explained that a body had washed up in Keating's Cove, a beach not far from where the Mary Bernice had capsized. The dead fisherman wore his yellow oilskins, a green hand-knit sweater, and his kingfisher hip boots. The middle finger on his right hand was crooked, bent from a previous injury. A small gunny bag hung around his neck. A cloth pendant of the Blessed Mary and a medal of the Virgin's mother, St. Anne, were tucked inside. "My mother knew it was my father from his crooked finger and the sweater she had knit for him," Bride remembered. "He was so long in the water, his body was broken up, so they just put him in the grave there." Decades later, Bride and her sister visited her father's burial place in Port Royal, a small community near Coffin's Cove and Haystack, the village where the Mary Bernice had been towed to shore. Bride and her sister sat by their father's grave, boiled tea on the beach rocks, and prayed. "My daddy used to like his tea, so we had our cup with him and cried. He always said, 'If I drown, I don't want to be buried at sea.' After all his suffering, at least his body made it to shore." Now 86 and living in a senior citizen's complex in Boston, Bride pulls the picture of her dad from a drawer to show a visitor. She eyes her father's face, his smooth, youthful skin. The photograph was taken when he was in his 30s, 2 decades before his death. "A long time has gone by, but I'm always thinking about him and the gale and the other poor souls who went down with him. I always wonder what my life would have been like if my poor daddy hadn't drowned." Like Bride Hanrahan, the August gale children and widows pondered the same question, lamenting how their fate would have been different if the hurricane had veered away from Newfoundland on that summer night in 1935. "They were all left in a dreamland," says Gerald Hoff, who married Patty Walsh's youngest daughter, Lillian. "The families had 2 lives, before the gale and then after. For many of the survivors, it was harder being left behind. They were stuck in time, trapped by memories and grief." Less than a year after she was placed in the St. John's Belvedere Orphanage, Lillian Walsh returned home to Marystown. A picture of her, taken soon after she reunited with her family, shows her standing in a field of daisies outside her house. Her aunt, uncle, and younger brother, Paddy Jr., stand with her in the garden. Lillian wears a dress and a slight, forced smile. In her hand she holds a bouquet of flowers that she has picked, a gift, perhaps, for her mother. For the most part, her older sisters, Lottie and Tessie, looked after Lillian and Paddy Jr. while their mother continued to grieve. Eventually, after Lillian completed her grammar and secondary education, she left Marystown to study nursing in St. John's. She worked in the operating room and supervised her own floor of hospital patients. She earned a reputation as a skilled and unflappable medical professional. Like her father Paddy, she did not shy away from a challenge or a patient who needed calming or a stern word. A stroke victim later in life, Lillian ended up in a nursing home, in pain and unable to control her limbs. Shortly before her death, she bemoaned her crippled body and the tragedy that had claimed her beloved father and brothers. For years, she wished that her dad had taken her with him on that fateful journey. Depressed and distraught, she cried to her husband, "I wish I had sailed with my dad and brothers that day. I wish it was me in that boat." Lillian's younger brother, Paddy Jr., struggled with his own sorrow and confusion over the tragedy that claimed his father and three brothers. He grew up in Marystown, shadowed by his dad's legacy. The young boy became accustomed to fishermen's voices trailing his footsteps. "Aye, that's Captain Paddy Walsh's son. Only Walsh male not taken by the sea." Out of respect for his father, Paddy Jr. received special treatment from captains, who allowed him to board their vessels and climb the masts. Still, the boy longed for his dad and three older brothers. Surrounded by women in his home, he was lonely and bereft of male companionship. In a photograph taken soon after the gale, Paddy sits on a fence post in the corner of his yard. His hair is curled in ringlets that obscure his face. His gaze is cast downward, forlorn. Facing east toward the ocean, his small body is framed by the bay as it reflects the summer light. For 2 years after the storm, he woke at night screaming, unsure of where he was or what terrified him. Unable to cure the young boy, the local doctor suggested his mother Lillian ask the priest for help. Reverend John Fleming, who would replace Father McGettigan, stopped Paddy on his way to school one morning. He rested his hands on top of the boy's head and uttered several prayers. "You will be fine now, Paddy," the priest explained. Paddy never had another bout of nightmares or hysteria. In the years that followed, he dreamt about captaining a schooner like his father, but Paddy never pursued a life on the sea because he knew such a decision would break his mother's heart. Instead, he continued to row the family dory across the bay to attend the Catholic school located on Marystown's northern shore. There, in the five-room school run by the Sisters of Mercy, Paddy earned his high school diploma. Eventually, he left Marystown and settled in Calgary, where he became a stockbroker, married, and had three daughters of his own. In 2001, 66 years after the August gale, Paddy's eldest daughter decided Marystown would provide a fitting backdrop for her father's 70th birthday. With the approval of Alan Brenton, who owned Captain Paddy's former house, and the local mayor, Jerome Walsh, a party was planned in the meadow, where the skipper's cows and sheep once grazed. On a warm August afternoon, scores of relatives, grandchildren, cousins, nieces, nephews, and other gray-haired men and women who had lost their fathers to the 1935 hurricane, gathered to celebrate Paddy Jr.'s birthday and to remember the gale that forever changed their small community. Tables and tents were set up in Skipper Paddy's old field. Music played, memories were shared, and the legendary doryman, Jim Pad Kelly, sang sea shanties and told stories about the devil that danced on the water that summer so long ago. When the local newspaper reporter asked Paddy how it felt to be home, he explained, "When you leave a place you love, you can take a little bit of it with you, and you leave a little bit of it behind, but it will always be home." Among the 70 people attending the reunion was Jamie Walsh, the baby born the night of the gale. Like Paddy, Jamie relished the opportunity to be among family, to remember the town where she had lived as a young girl. Birthed the night her father, Captain James Walsh, drowned, Jamie never recovered from losing both parents at an early age. After her mother, Lucy, abandoned her at the age of 6 months, Jamie was raised by her grandparents in Little Bay. 7 years passed before Jamie's mother returned to Marystown. "That was the first time I'd ever seen her," Jamie recalled. "Then she left again for the States. My grandparents could not have been any better raising me. but I always had an insecure feeling like someone would always be leaving me. Jamie would wait another 8 years before her mother remarried and could afford to take her to California. 15 and used to living in a small outport of 800, Jamie was overwhelmed with the cars, crowds, and the noise in her new home. She also felt like an unwelcome stranger in her mother's company. Her mother, Lucy, could not look past the cruel irony. As her daughter drew her first breath, her husband took his last. "She always resented me for it," Jamie remembered. While her mother refused to talk about Marystown, her deceased husband, or anything connected to the sea, Jamie collected model schooners, lighthouses, and pictures of sea captains and sailors, and she always wondered, "What if my daddy had lived? Would he have held me and sung to me, taken me fishing on his schooner?" 3 weeks after Patty Jr.'s party, Jamie and several other August Gale children gathered for a memorial service on August 25th, the anniversary of the storm. Dorymen John Brinton's daughters, Mary, Sadie, and Teresa, and fisherman Michael Farrell's son, Michael Jr., sat in the front pew of the Sacred Heart Church with Jamie to remember their fathers. The gray-haired men and women held each other and wept as the service concluded. "None of us ever forgot the loss," Jamie said, "ever." Like her granddaughter, Lillian Walsh carried the memories of the August Gale close to her heart for the remainder of her life. She also chose to remain single. "I'll never find another man like Patty," she told relatives, "so I'm not going to bother trying." For the first 5 years following the gale, she continued to wear black and spent much of her time isolated in her home. After countless hours staring at the bay, watching for Patty's returning sails, she could no longer bear to view the water. She moved the parlor couch and chairs away from the windows, turning her back on the tides, the rhythm of the sea that she had grown to know so well. Rarely did she venture outside, preferring to remain in her darkened rooms, sewing and conjuring memories of the past. "For a long time she didn't know if she was in this world or the other," her son-in-law Gerald Hoff recalled. Her two eldest girls, Lottie and Tessie, watched over their mother and tried to pull Lillian from her stupor. The summer after the storm, the three of them sat on a wooden bench outside their home. Flanked by her daughters, Lillian wore a black dress, stockings, and a large dark bow around her neck. Her mournful attire is stark against the white picket fence and her daughters' light-colored dresses. I imagine that someone had coaxed Lillian outside for some fresh air, sunshine, and a family portrait. But it is clear that she was there reluctantly. In the picture, her lips are pressed together tightly, her white hands folded in her lap. Lillian's daughters wrapped their arms around their mother's shoulders, holding her close, trying to boost her spirits. "Don't ever believe that you can die from a broken heart," Lillian often told her family and friends, "because if it were true, I'd be dead." In 1950, she sold the home on the hill, the old Malloy Hotel that Patty had bought as a surprise for her. She lived with her daughter Lillian for several years in Chapel's Cove, and she told stories about the August Gale over and over to anyone who would listen. She recounted her premonitions the night before her husband sailed, the terrible deaths that befell her three sons and husband, and the misidentified body that led to Tom Reed being buried in Patty's grave. When her husband's youngest brother Ambrose finally returned to Newfoundland in 1975, he visited Lillian. "The two of them sat at the table telling stories till the air turned blue," Gerald remembered. "They were both fond of talking of the past. Neither one of them got over losing Patty. He was Ambrose's hero and Lillian's one and only love." 2 weeks before she celebrated her 90th birthday, Lillian died of cancer. Her body was returned to Marystown, where she was buried next to her son Frankie's grave. Not immune to the sorrow that gripped his community, Father McGettigan found himself caught up in his own grief following the gale. He continued to hear odd noises in the church, a rustling like the sound of oilskins. His parishioners noticed the dark circles beneath the priest's eyes and his haunted gaze. McGettigan could barely look at Patty's empty, abandoned wharf. The priest knew there would be no more shouting, cursing, and singing from the skipper as he set sail or returned home. Patty's voice, like the voices of the other August Gale fishermen, was silent, still now. Soon after the first anniversary of Marystown's tragedy, McGettigan received orders to serve in St. Mary's Bay, along the southern coast of the Avalon Peninsula, where the Annie Anita had washed ashore. Several in the Marystown congregation were eager to see the gruff priest depart, while others mourned his exodus. Before he left, he stopped to say goodbye and offer a prayer for Patty's widow, who he knew would struggle for a good long while. Picking up Patty Jr. in his arms, McGettigan encouraged the 5-year-old boy to behave as best he could. "Be good to your mother, son." Though he desired to put the sorrow of the August gale behind him, misfortune and poor luck followed the priest. The second anniversary of the August gale had barely passed when a storm struck St. Mary's Bay. McGettigan's young maid, Lizzie, who had moved with the priest, stood outside the presbytery, admiring the last summer roses as the sky darkened. Suddenly she heard a loud crack and saw a flash of light. A thunderbolt struck the rectory. The lightning shattered the chandeliers and blasted the bedroom where Father McGettigan brushed his hair, preparing for Mass. The bolt blackened the priest's bronze bed and knocked McGettigan face first to the floor. Outside, the lightning burned a ribbon of grass down to the bay. Shaken and temporarily stunned, the priest recovered, but he became especially wary of dark skies and summer storms. Before his retirement, McGettigan served in 2 more parishes, and he found himself delivering several more death notices to widows who lost their men to the sea. Yet he never faced another catastrophe like the August gale. In the years before he died, McGettigan returned to live in St. John's, where he enjoyed the city's fine restaurants and plays. In his quiet hours, alone before the parlor fire, he sipped his rum and reminisced about his time in Marystown and his surly and fearless friend, Captain Paddy. When the memories of the gale overwhelmed him, the priest sought solace from the books that lined his walls. Often he read works from the British poet, Alfred Lord Tennyson. One poem in particular captured his emotions and sorrowful recollections of the storm. He read the words so often he could recite them by heart. "Break, break, break on thy cold gray stones, O sea, and I would that my tongue could utter the thoughts that arise in me. Oh, well for the fisherman's boy that he shouts with his sister at play. Oh, well for the sailor lad that he sings in his boat on the bay. And the stately ships go on to their haven under the hill. But oh, for the touch of a vanished hand and the sound of a voice that is still. Break, break, break at the foot of thy crags, O sea. But the tender grace of a day that is dead will never come back to me." The Marystown fishermen's voices had been stilled, their hands forever vanished in the sea. Yet one voice still resonated in McGettigan's mind, one image still held strong. The priest saw Captain Paddy, his hand on the helm. He heard the skipper's shouts commanding the crew, "Heave up the anchor, hoist the sails, we're away again, lads." "Fair seas to you, Paddy," the priest whispered. "Rest in peace in the waters that you loved." And we've reached the end of episode 16 of August Gale by Barbara Walsh. Our next episode, number 17, will be the final one for this book. I'm Susan Wall. Thank you for listening.